Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, and welcome to EAN Cast, weekly neurology, the weekly audio podcast by EAN. My name is Cristian Fallo Pecurario. I am professor of neurology at Transylvania University, Chair Department of Neurology, County Clinic Hospital in Brașov, Romania. I am co-chair of EN Autonomic Nervous System Disorders Scientific Panel, member of the Program Committee of EN, past chair of Education Committee of MDS-ES, former member of International Executive Committee of MDS. I am married. I have one son. This month, topic is autonomic nervous system disorder of panel of autonomic, which is a dynamic panel with outstanding members like a teamwork in practice. And today's episode, we will talk about a cardiovascular autonomic dysfunction. My guests today are two giants in the field, and it's really a privilege to have Professor Alessandra Fanciulli and Professor Rolantis for this podcast. Professor Alessandra Fanciulli holds a tenure-track professorship in autonomic neuroscience and is the director of the Dysautonomia Center at the Department of Neurology at the Medical University of Innsbruck. Her research focuses on syncope and autonomic failure in Parkinsonian and other neurodegenerative disorders. She coordinates FWF-funded consortium on medical decision-making in multiple system atrophy, studies on pain in people living with multiple system atrophy, and on post-COVID-19 cardiovascular autonomic disorders. Dr. Fanciulli is the secretary of the European Federation of Autonomic Societies and of Austrian Autonomic Society. For the EN, she coordinated the upcoming guidelines on the diagnosis and treatment of neurogenic urogenital dysfunction and on symptomatic treatment of atypical Parkinsonian syndromes. In 2020, she received the Bilateral Scientific Cooperation Award of the Italian Minister of Foreign Affairs. Most importantly, Alessandra is mom to three marvelous boys. Dr. Tisch is an academic neurologist and clinical leader with a special expertise and interest in clinical autonomic disorders. He is appointed as a consultant neurologist and a clinical director at Schichting Epilepsy Instellingen, Netherlands, as a consultant neurologist and senior clinical lecturer at Leiden University Medical Center, and as honorary research associate at the Queen's Square Institute of Neurology, University College London in UK. A project which brought him a special recognition includes his studies on syncope semiology and tilt table testing. In 2023, he was awarded by the RIP Heart Rhythm Alliance as a syncope healthcare pioneer for his implementation studies in the emergency ward. His team reported an improvement in diagnostic yield, accuracy, and societal costs. Dr. Tisch has strong links with the international cardiological and neurological communities and serves as the president of the European Federation of Autonomic Societies, EFAS. He enjoys running, poetry, and free time with his two sons. Alessandra and Roland, welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for your invitation, Christian.
Thank you. I'm going to start with the first question. Which are the symptoms and signs of cardiovascular autonomic disorders?
Yes, this is an important question. There are many, many symptoms that may occur, and the most prominent one is being lightheaded or having blurred vision. But there are many other symptoms that may occur. Of course, if it becomes severe, the cardiovascular failure, it turns out to be syncope, so someone passes out. But it may not always be as severe as that, and it may co-occur with a lot of additional, more subtle symptoms. If blood pressure is lowered a bit, but doesn't cause passing out, people may at the end also have some vagueness, slowing of thinking, neck pain, all kind of vague symptoms that not always be will not always be attributed to low blood pressure. And these symptoms may not be experienced by the subject him or herself, but be seen by others. Sometimes there are some co-occurring symptoms that may signify the cause, like severe palpitations in people with cardiac syncope, or signs that actually show us, tell us that the autonomic system is hyperactive. And an important hyperactive symptom is being nauseous or vomiting or sweating. This, in fact, tells us that the autonomic nervous system is at that time very active. And this is an important clue for, in this case, reflex syncope.
Thank you. The second question, the TLOC, the transient loss of consciousness, etiology of syncope, when are recommended tilt table tests?
Yes, so these are very important umbrella terms to think of when doing clinics. So the first major category of patients when to think of autonomic causes are those who present with transient loss of consciousness. And this refers to the situation that someone has a transient episode where consciousness is completely lost. And you can derive this from history taking by the fact that the subject, him or herself, cannot recall the event, that if bystanders tried to make contact to the subject, that the subject didn't respond. And finally, that the subject could not keep upright. So the subject lost tone, postural tone, due to either jerking or to a flaccid tone. So if you can tick off all these boxes and fulfill all these criteria, then you can establish a presentation diagnosis of transient loss of consciousness. And this narrows down your differential diagnosis to three major categories. So the first one being reflex syncope, the second one is orthostatic hypotension, and the third one is a cardiac syncope. So these are the sort of autonomic variants. And then we also have two categories that look alike, and that's a tonic-clonic seizure due to epilepsy. And this can be a focal onset tonic-clonic seizure or a generalized onset tonic-clonic seizure, or it may be functional. So it's very helpful to keep this in mind, because then you have a sort of narrowed down your differential diagnosis. And the challenge for us as neurologists is to pick out when the cardiac syncope is there, because then we cannot manage it ourselves. We have to refer to the cardiologist. Of course, we should think of epilepsy and of functional disorders. But I think the major challenge for our neurological community is to strengthen our skills to identify at an earlier stage reflex syncope with certainty and orthostatic hypotension. The second category, the presentation, is orthostatic intolerance, which refers to the situation that someone feels lightheaded upon standing, and all these other more subtle symptoms I referred to in the prior question, and that these symptoms can be alleviated by getting seated or by lying down. And if you have this particular situation, you also have a more narrow differential diagnosis. And in terms of autonomic causes, we have orthostatic hypotension as a broad category. And Professor Fanciulli will tell us more about the variants there are. Initial orthostatic hypotension, classic orthostatic hypotension, and delayed orthostatic hypotension. But as you already hear, it has much to do with the timing of the events in response to the standing. We have postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And then it may also happen that people with vasovagal syncope at times may have problems upon standing. So you can also consider this cause. But this is sort of the major group when thinking of orthostatic intolerance. And it helps to think in these presentations because it makes life easier also in terms of thinking of what to do with ancillary testing.
Thank you. The next question, when a neurologist should think at neurogenic age?
Oh, this is for me, this question. Thank you, Christian, for asking. Basically, Roland anticipated already, but orthostatic hypertension can present in a very unspecific way. So we should have a high level of alertness for symptoms of end organ hypoperfusion. This might be, for example, troubles concentrating, lightheadedness, dizziness, or visual changes due to retinal hypoperfusion, or the coat hanger pain, which means pain in the shoulder and neck region due to muscular hypoperfusion, or even less specifically, fatigue or weakness that develop when standing or from the sitting position on when walking up a hill or climbing stairs. So this is the specific bit of the symptoms of neurogenic orthostatic hypotension when they develop in the upright position and produce an overwhelming urge to sit down. Eventually, by sitting down, these symptoms alleviate. But overall, they can interfere with daily activities, be very disabling, and when severe, can lead to faintings and falls. Indeed, in elderly patients, an unexplained fall, which means a fall which I cannot clearly explain with a slip or a trip, is to be considered as an unexplained syncope, especially if exacerbating or occurring after a large meal or in a overheated person or in a dehydrated person after alcohol consumption or during physical exercise. As Dr. Theis mentioned, there are several types of orthostatic hypertension. The term initial or transient orthostatic hypertension is a fall in blood pressure which develops soon after we stand up from the seated or supine position and goes away within 1 minute. This is very frequent both in the young and elderly population, but in the elderly population has been associated with syncope, orthostatic intolerance, and even falls. The classic orthostatic hypotension is something which we diagnosed after 3 minutes upon standing, but especially in the early stages, a diagnostic fall or a clinically meaningful fall in blood pressure might occur after, let's say, 5 to 10 minutes or even longer, and this condition is called delayed orthostatic hypotension. It is very important to identify it because it is considered a prodromal or initial form of classic orthostatic hypotension. So this means we need to follow up this affected person quite closely. Other forms of hypotension are the so-called postprandial hypotension, which occurs in the 2 hours after a main meal due to blood pooling in the splanchnic region. And with a similar mechanism, the so-called exercise-induced hypotension, because due to exercise, we have a vasodilation in big muscle groups, which the baroreflex is unable to compensate due to an autonomic disorder.
Thank you. The next question would be related to Parkinsonism. Which is the role of cardiovascular autonomy disorders in differential diagnosis of Parkinsonism?
Thank you for this question, Christine. Indeed, cardiovascular autonomic failure plays a very important role in the differential diagnosis of Parkinsonism and especially of multiple system atrophy. And a typical Parkinsonian disorder characterized by a combination of poorly levodopa responsive Parkinsonism, cerebellar ataxia, cardiovascular and urogenital autonomic failure in various combinations. Multiple system atrophy is oftentimes described as a wolf in sheep's clothes because at the beginning might masquerade as Parkinson's disease or be difficult to distinguish from other atypical Parkinsonian syndromes. But exactly in this case, the presence of cardiovascular autonomic failure has a high diagnostic implication. For example, the occurrence of cardiovascular autonomic failure early on in the disease course has a high negative predictive value for the diagnosis of tauopathies. For example, in the case of progressive supranuclear palsy, which is another atypical Parkinsonism, the presence of a predominant, otherwise unexplained orthostatic hypotension is an exclusion criteria for such a diagnosis. And the same applies to corticobasal degeneration, where the presence of orthostatic hypotension represents an exclusion criterion. As for Parkinson's disease, things are a bit more complex because indeed every third person with Parkinson's disease might develop orthostatic hypotension during the course of during natural history of the disease, but studies show that orthostatic hypotension occurs overall more frequently in MSA than in Parkinson's disease and at the early disease stages. However, the problem which clinicians have in their daily practice is that these studies deliver results from group-wise comparisons, while what we usually have in front of ourselves is one single patient where we are called to take a decision. And so quite some research has been done in the last years comparing the occurrence of autonomic failure in early disease stages versus more advanced. And so it could be shown that at early disease stages, that means in the first 2 years of disease, the presence of two or more autonomic features, including orthostatic hypotension, urinary incontinence, or urinary retention, is actually highly predictive of a final multiple system atrophy diagnosis. As the disease progresses, also people with Parkinson's disease, as I mentioned, develop orthostatic hypotension and might develop some urinary urge and urinary incontinence, but still, urinary retention remains highly specific of a multiple system atrophy diagnosis. In recent years, so MSA researchers also worked on composing scores for early identifying multiple system atrophy at bedside at the early disease stages. And indeed, they found that combining such autonomic features with other motor features such as postural instability or poor undetermined dopaminergic responsiveness or the presence of some postural deformities such as hand or foot dystonia, anticollis, or the so-called PISA syndrome, that is when your spine is bent to one side, you have a very high sensitivity and specificity for a diagnosis of MSA, which might tell you that this very person is at higher risk of suffering from MSA and might deserve second-line investigation. Beyond the differential diagnosis of sporadic Parkinsonian disorders, autonomic failure also develops in some genetic Parkinsonian conditions, for example, in Parkinson's disease due to synuclein mutation, or due to a GBA mutation where it has been described by several groups that autonomic impairment is severe and occurs early in the disease course. In this case, the family history is the clue for appropriate diagnosis. And there are also some rare genetic conditions. For example, Perry syndrome, where mutation in the DCTNI1 gene might cause a clinical presentation of levodopa unresponsive Parkinsonism with early falls, gait freezing within the first 2 years from disease onset, dysautonomia. But here the clue are prominent respiratory problems in the first 2 years of the disease. In recent years, we have also learned that sometimes both multiple system atrophy and Parkinson's disease may present with autonomic failure, so with isolated or pure autonomic failure. And of course, there is much research going on trying to understand or to foretell which people will eventually retain an isolated autonomic failure phenotype or ultimately phenoconvert to Parkinson's disease or multiple system atrophy. And in this case, the pattern of autonomic dysfunction is also very important, because people presenting with pure autonomic failure who will ultimately phenoconvert to MSA will show a more severe and widespread autonomic impairment, including also the urinary and gastrointestinal domain, and will show a preganglionic pattern of autonomic nervous system dysfunction. That means that if we measure the norepinephrine level in plasma, this will be normal in people who will phenoconvert, who are harboring multiple system atrophy, and usually reduced in people who have a pure autonomic failure, so the stable pure autonomic failure phenotype, or who might later on phenoconvert to Parkinson's disease or dementia with Lewy body, which are neuronal alpha synucleinopathies, compared to multiple, so in contrast with multiple system atrophy, which is an oligodendroglial alpha synucleinopathy.
Good, thank you, Alessandra. So we had the definition, diagnosis, assessment, and finally, a question related to how to treat orthostatic hypotension.
Thank you. This question is very important indeed in clinical practice, because neurologists are often called to manage people with this kind of disturbances. And the first step when treating orthostatic hypotension is not to add something, but to review and identify possible exacerbating factors. For example, have a look whether there is an ongoing infection, whether there is an anemia, or reintegrate fluids in case you see a dehydration on clinical grounds. Another very important thing is to review the medication schedule, because sometimes these people have a polypharmacy. And so culprits for exacerbating orthostatic hypotension are not only the classical blood pressure lowering drugs, but also many drugs which we as a neurologist like to use. In Parkinson's disease setting, of course, dopaminergic medication, but also some antidepressants, neuroleptics, hypnotics, and painkillers. Step number two, in case all these exacerbating factors have been excluded or treated, is to add non-pharmacological measures, and especially behavioral measures. So take time to explain the affected person which measures can be of benefit, for example, the counter-pressure maneuvers, which is like clenching fist or buttocks when standing. This effectively raises the blood pressure, increase the water and salt intake, and head up tilt sleep overnight. There are indeed trials ongoing in Parkinson's disease setting from Dr. Theis to prove whether this measure is feasible and effective in Parkinson's disease. Another non-pharmacological measures which has been investigated and proven effective is the use of compression garments like elastic abdominal binders and to some extent also compression stockings, which helps preventing this blood venous pooling both in the legs and in the belly. There are also some things which people with orthostatic hypertension should try to avoid, to not worsen their symptoms. And these are exactly so heat exposures, large meals rich in carbohydrates, and alcohol consumption, because alcohol has a vasodilatory effects and a diuretic effects, so both counterproductive in the setting of orthostatic hypotension. But eventually, many people suffering, especially from neurogenic orthostatic hypertension, so with an underlying damage of the autonomic nervous system, will require pharmacological treatment. And this is based on the neuropharmacology or the neurophysiology of the autonomic nervous system. On one hand, we might enhance the ganglionic transmission between the pre- and post-ganglionic sympathetic neurons. This is a cholinergic transmission, so nicotinic cholinergic transmission, which we might enhance with cholinesterase inhibitors. Some are off-label, for example, pyridostigmine, but some others, for example, rivastigmine, are frequently used in the setting of Parkinson's disease with dementia to treat cognitive symptoms. And research has shown that this might have an indirect positive effect also on orthostatic hypotension. Otherwise, other drug treatments target the noradrenergic transmission at a presynaptic level with droxidopa, which is a noradrenaline precursor. This is not available in Europe, but can be purchased over international pharmacies, and it is an option in people with side effects from other drugs. And there is research ongoing exploiting the noradrenaline transporter blocker to enhance the noradrenergic transmission, so the noradrenergic concentration in the synaptic cleft. Eventually, some drugs might be used to directly stimulate alpha-1 adrenergic receptors at the level of the blood vessels. And these are, for example, midodrine, which is one of the most investigated drugs, or older drugs like etilefrin. Finally, another option is to increase the plasmatic volume, and this is done with a synthetic mineral corticoid agent, which is fludrocortisone, which can be considered. A small percentage of these patients will, in fact, won't have a good symptomatic control with one medication only. And so what physicians might consider in treatment-resistant cases is to combine different approaches. And what is usually done in clinical practice is to combine fludrocortisone with sympathomimetic agents. For postprandial hypotension, there are some additional measures, both non-pharmacological, for example, fractionating the daily caloric intake in 5 meals or avoiding alcohol at mealtime, or also pharmacological measures like low-dose caffeine or drugs borrowed from the diabetes therapy like acarbose. Finally, there are some measures which for parenteral application like octreotide, which lowers the secretion of gastrointestinal vasodilatory peptides and so combats postprandial hypotension. When managing orthostatic hypotension in clinical practice, clinicians should be aware that even without treatment, about 50% of people with neurogenic OH suffer from a paradoxical hypertension in the supine position. This is due to baroreflex failure and needs to be considered in clinical practice and when present, treated with preventive measures, non-pharmacological measures, and in severe cases with bedtime administration of short-acting blood pressure-lowering drugs.
Thank you very much. And now to conclude, from both sides of you, take home message for the information that you very nicely delivered.
Thank you, Christian, for having us here. I hope we sparked your enthusiasm in the autonomic field. And there's much more to learn for us as neurologists from the autonomic symptoms. And I think there's a lot of opportunities also within the EFAS community to learn more. And we are looking forward to the EON Joint Congress in Helsinki, where there are many sessions to be appreciated and to improve the knowledge. And I also recommend our website here from EFAS.
Thank you very much, Alessandra and Roland, for this very nice podcast. We learn many, many things. And on behalf of the Autonomic Nervous System Disorder Scientific Panel, I would like to thank to Ian for this important educational activity. Thank you very much, Rafaela, for organizing very nicely through the weeks before, and to Anya for the excellent effort of the logistics. Thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye. Have a great day.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. ENCAST Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.